come, tie, come, tie, 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 come. Tie, come, tie, come, tie, 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 come. Tie, come, tie, come, tie, 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 come. So download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Got a great show tonight. I'm very excited. Steve Gadlin is back. He'll be here at 10 o'clock to pitch his newest idea. Of course, Steve Gadlin from Shark Tank fame. I want to draw a cat for you.com. The Chicago entrepreneur has a development deal with Mark Cuban. Before he gives his ideas to Mark, he brings them to WGN Radio, and we tell him if they're good or not. Most of the time, we tell him they're not. Because, hey, I don't think he's had a successful one. This is week number six, and I don't think he's yet had a yay. But tonight might be the night. Also coming up, we're going to talk with the Reader, Chicago Reader, about their Best of Chicago. And also, Elena Delladone, the WNBA superstar at this point, odds-on favorite to be the MVP after after seven or eight games for the Chicago Sky. They're playing the Indiana Fever tonight, and later this hour, she's going to join us to talk about her unbelievable start. She broke a WNBA record for most points scored, so we're going to talk to her coming up later on the show. But right now, joining me on the big table, that's what I call this segment, sort of the big table. It's like my ode to Charlie Rose. He's got the circle table. We've got the big table, right? This week, you know, we got more news about Pete Rose, you know, and gambling. New evidence came out that Rose was betting on his own team when manager for the Reds. Inevitably, the conversation goes to the Hall of Fame. And then inevitably, someone will say, well, they let Ty Cobb in the Hall. Why not Rose? And that argument, of course, relies on the nation's view of who Ty Cobb was. I mean, what do I know about him? I know that, you know, he was a baseball player. You know, he's very good, but also nasty, sharp in spikes. He's a racist, beat up fans, booze, pills, worst ever, worst player ever. But is it possible that Ty Cobb was a victim of a smear campaign, or just the facts are distorted over the years? What if Ty Cobb wasn't a bad guy, just his legend was? It's a fascinating thought. Charles Learson is the former executive editor of Sports Illustrated. He's written a new biography called Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. He joins me tonight on the download. Charles, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure, Justin.
Fascinating take. I mean, the idea that Ty Cobb might not be as bad of a guy that we all think he is or thought he was.
It is, and it's not where I started out when I went into this project. I was very much a believer in the myths I've been hearing all my life, because, you know, baseball myths are like sacred. You hear them from your dad usually, you know, so it's sacred information. And you hear them over and over and over, and, you know, you think they must be true. That's where I was. Somewhere in the files of Simon & Schuster, my publisher, is a proposal for a book that I never wrote, because I thought, I'm going to write a fresh book about the monster, Ty Cobb. I'm just going to find fresh examples, and that's going to be kind of fun. One of the first things I did was I went to his grave in Royston, Georgia. Wow. It's a mausoleum, above ground grave, and there's a window you could look in. And I looked in and I saw, you know how you hear that your fingernails and your hair grow after you're dead? And I imagine him in this like monstrous, like Howard Hughes kind of guy, you know, in his coffin, and the evil man. And then I started to do real research, you know, and then I found out that the story was very different. And along the way, I also found out that your hair and nails don't grow after you're dead. So you can't believe everything you hear just because you've heard it over and over and over.
Right.
You know, it doesn't make it true.
Well, this, you know, it Ty Cobb played at the almost turn of the century, 20th century, early 1900s. And there was a time, and that was an interesting time in baseball. It was an interesting time in our country. There wasn't necessarily this this huge sort of, you know, apparatus of celebrity and pop culture at that time. He sort of invented it, or he was like as the country sort of developed that, he was sort of the first celebrity ever.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time in history. You know, as revolutionary as the last 20 years has been with the digital revolution and whatnot, and that has been a big deal, I think that the period between like 1880 and 1910 or 15 is even more revolutionary, because think of what happened, the widespread electricity, you had the invention of the airplane, the movie camera, the typewriter, you had the advent of women coming to the fore, and, you know, that was upsetting both for the women and the men, you know, it was a necessary progress, but it upset everyone. So it was a time of great upheaval, and you had also mass entertainment, because you had people no longer working 7 days a week. They're working six and a half now, and they make it a little more money. the Civil War era is behind them. It's this, what in school we called it the Second Industrial Revolution,
right.
and we learned about it. So there's more leisure time. You have the movies coming in. You have vaudeville, and you have major sports as entertainment, things you could bring your family to. 20, 30 years before that simply didn't exist. So Cobb was in that first wave. He came up in 1905. The American League was only invented in 1901, so we only had Major League Baseball as we know it for 4 years before then. So everything was new, and ballplayers were thought of differently. They were more like carnies or circus performers. They weren't the superstars and the celebrities that we know now. They weren't asked for their autograph in 1905 so much. But in the next 10 years, that would change.
It was really when baseball started to build stadiums and sort of get more money that was
exactly.
coming in. But before that, he played at a time when you know, it's fascinating to me because there's nothing that really, you know, there's so many myths, and I want to get into them in while we talk. We'll take a mm-hmm. quick break before we do that. But there's so many myths about him, whether it be fighting with fans, whether it be sort of boozing up and pills before the game. The big one, of course, is the sharpened spikes. And all this stuff you look into, and all this stuff has either, you know, a reason for it or just didn't happen. And that's just fascinating. And I also want to make it clear that you're not saying that Ty Cobb still may have been a jerk. That's it could be.
He's not a saint.
Yeah,
he's not a saint. Yeah.
But who was at that time? Right?
Right, yeah.
Well, we're talking with Charles Learson here, former executive editor at Sports Illustrated, wrote a biography, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, about the myth and the who was Ty Cobb. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more with you here on The Download. Stay with us. The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Charles Learson. He's the former executive editor of Sports Illustrated. He's written a new biography called Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. In it, he ruins everything we know about Ty Cobb.
Sorry.
No. You know, and it's one of those things that if you can't believe this story, and it is a story, like you said, that was passed down from generation to generation. I remember being in a little league. Kid has a metal spikes on. They're like, oh, who do you think you are, Ty Cobb?
Right.
You know, and let's go back to when he played. From your research on Ty Cobb, was he a bad guy? Like, did at the time, were there a lot of articles, were there anecdotal information about him being a guy that nobody wanted to be around?
The short answer is no. He had a reputation as an extremely fierce player, extremely competitive. His personal philosophy was to be a mental hazard for the other team. Now, that sounds like a commonsensical thing right now. We're so used to sports and we're so used to people doing that. But believe it or not, in 1905, when he came up, they still had those 19th century notions of sports, and it was considered ungentlemanly to mess with the other guy's mind. Or to be, you know, the president of Harvard, a guy named, I think his name was Eliot, he was against baseball because he was against the curveballs, rather, because he thought they were unsportsmanlike, too tricky, you know. And he thought, if you were a football player, you shouldn't try to be dodgy and you know, supple, or, you know, you should just plow into the scrum. You know. That was the sportsmanlike, the manly thing to do. So Cobb had this philosophy of being a mental hazard, and of course that made him a little unpopular with some people. He's always trying to mess you up, always trying to be a disruptive force. So that and the public had a fascination with spikes at the time, because this was a new thing. The people sitting in the stands in 1905, 1910 did not play scholastic baseball. They had no personal experience with spikes.
It's a new game, right?
Right. So to them, they were kind of a combination of like a sci-fi or medieval. And I found articles in the paper saying, well, spikes, they got to do something because spikes in general are going to be, people are going to get killed, they said. Well, you know, no one's ever been killed by spikes, and it's easier to kill someone with a bat or a ball. But to get back to Cobb in particular, so he did have this reputation among some out-of-town sports writers for being that way.
Things today that would people would say that's the most sportsmanlike thing to do.
Right, that's clever.
Right,
that's a good way to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
So he did have that, but most people, including the ballplayers, I found to a man, teammates, some of whom weren't his best buddies even, supported, said he doesn't spike people. He doesn't come in high. He doesn't play the game any in the wrong way.
Right.
To a man, everyone said that's what some of the civilians say. But we're the players. We know how the game is played, and he doesn't do that. Now, having said that, there was a right-of-way question that was being hashed out that at the time baseball was new, you know, so these questions had to be hashed out. And Cobb and the players in general believed that there was this patch in front of the bag. That was the base runner's right. If you wanted to stick your hand or your foot there, that was, as they said in those days, that was on your watch. And you took responsibility for that. So you might get hit with spikes. But Cobb had 9 different slides. He was an artist of the slide. And all of them were about giving the other guy as little to touch as possible. Because that's what you want to do, right? You don't want to get tagged out if you're sliding in. So it was kind of the opposite. In fact, but this myth stuck with Cobb and it annoyed the heck out of him. He was a smart guy and a very testy guy. So in 1910, he actually wrote a letter to Ban Johnson, the American League president, and the Tigers released it to the paper, so you can find the clips. He asked the American League president to have a proclamation that the players had to file their spikes dull, and the umpires, before each game, had to inspect them to make sure they weren't
so
too sharp.
So it was the exact opposite.
It was the exact opposite. And there it is in black and white. You can find it in the newspapers.
You know, what about I had read that he was actually educated, and some of the players had a problem with that. I mean, at the time, like he's a little bit more well-read, and he kept to himself, and the fact that he was more interested in reading than maybe some of the other baseball players. But what about some of the other things we've heard about him? We've heard race thrown around, and he was a racist. We heard that he would sort of, I don't know, he'd be testy or he'd fight with fans, and of course the substance abuse.
Well, yeah. Well, okay, 3 different things, but let's say that he's a fierce guy and very competitive guy, and a lot of these myths kind of fit with that, but they're exaggerations sometimes to the point where they're not even connected to the...
So you could see a guy fighting with a fan.
To the original man. Yeah. He did in May of 1912, he went into the fans. It wasn't Yankee Stadium then. Yankee Stadium wasn't built. It was called Highlander Park in Upper Manhattan in New York. And he beat up a guy who, when he got there and started throwing punches, the guy turned out to have only a total of 3 fingers. Now, this is, like I say, I didn't write a book to whitewash Cobb or to excuse Cobb. I just kind of let the chips fall where they may. And sometimes they fall on one side and sometimes they fall on the other. Now, so here, obviously, he shouldn't have done that. If you know the whole story, though, here's the whole story, is that guy was for a year harassing Cobb every time the Tigers came to New York. Cobb was well aware of him, had conversations, had shouted out, "Give me a break. I'm just trying to make a living down here." The guy was obscene and vulgar. Tigers had played the Yankees 3 games before this fateful day series. Every day that guy was there cursing out Cobb. And finally, somebody said, one of Cobb's teammates said, "You know, you're not going to take that anymore, are you?" Cobb had tried to that day again get the guy to go. That was it. But once that guy said that, Cobb ran into the stands, started throwing his fist. Now, the rest of the story is Cobb was suspended for that indefinitely by the American League president for doing that. But fan abuse was a hot topic in 1912. The players and the fans were working out the protocols and the etiquettes.
Mm-hmm.
And the players were mad that Cobb was suspended for beating up this abusive guy, and the players went out on strike. It was the first strike in Major League history in support of Ty Cobb, his teammates. So that flies in the face of the myth that Cobb had no friends and the team didn't support him. There were other instances, too, where the team supported him.
Everything, just like everything in this book and everything about Ty Cobb, it's all in context.
Right.
The idea that there is a fan player relationship issue that we may not understand now in our time in 2015 because of all the security and the way that they've separated those teams. That wasn't the case in 1912.
Yeah, baseball was new. The fans and were working out the protocols and the etiquettes. Sometimes they get mad at the umpire. In early 20th century, there's only one umpire on the field in a major league game. The fans would jump over the stands and chase the umpire. I mean, it sounds like something out of a silent movie.
Right.
And just the week before Cobb came up to the major leagues, the fans chased the umpire out of the stand, out of the field in Bennett Field in Detroit, out into the street, and the umpire called a forfeit against the Tigers. So that's the kind of atmosphere that Cobb came up in.
And so when did Ty Cobb play till?
He played until 1928, started in 1905 and played 1928. So it was an interesting era in baseball, from the very primitive time when ballplayers were like carnies, I said, and then to a time when Babe Ruth had come in and the game had changed dramatically by 28. So he spanned all those years.
That's an interesting point too, because he's probably an old school player in a new school world.
Exactly.
That would also make him sort of a fish out of water later in his career, as he's using some of those mental ways to get ahead in the game make an impression on other players.
Right. And he and Ruth clashed philosophically and almost physically on at least three occasions. They had to be separated on the field. Cobb very much resented. He wanted to be recognized, Cobb, as a great player that he was, and he resented the fact that when Ruth came along, the tension, the spotlight swung onto Ruth with his home run style. Of course, Ruth, it's one of the great serendipitous things in baseball history that Ruth and the live ball came along at the same time. The ball was manufactured differently in 1919 with a different kind of yarn. It was springier and bouncier, and Ruth was just then making the transition from pitcher to outfield, to everyday player, and the crowds were turning out for Ruth just as they had turned out for Cobb all the years.
Right.
Cobb was a great draw. He was the most exciting player in baseball, and Cobb, that did not sit well with Cobb.
We're talking with Charles Learson here, a former executive editor of Sports Illustrated, and also the author of the new biography on Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. When we come back, I'm going to take a break and stick around after the news here. I want to talk about Al Stumps, who was a real big part of the Ty Cobb story.
He sure was.
And we're going to talk more about him and sports writers at the time and what they had to do with contributing to the legacy of Ty Cobb. Charles Learson's here until we'll talk until the 9 o'clock hour. We'll see what the Blackhawks have to do, right?
Great.
Stay with us.
He retired in 1928 and died in 1962, just 6 months before Pete Rose made his National League debut. Hey, Ty Cobb, we remember you. And maybe Babe Ruth's in heaven, out in right field. Luke Gehrig's in heaven at first.
It's the download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Charles Learson. He's the former executive editor of Sports Illustrated. He's written a new biography called Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, which kind of takes a look at the myth of Ty Cobb. As we know, the nasty, evil Ty Cobb as sort of the villain of baseball. He always gets sort of, his name gets thrown around, turn of the century ball player who, you know, whenever Pete Rose is brought up, they say, well, they put Ty Cobb in the Hall of Fame. And it's a fascinating story because it's not just about baseball statistics. It's not just about sort of research of whether or not he did this or did this on the field. It's really about where our country was with pop culture, where it was with celebrity, and who was telling the story of Ty Cobb.
Yeah, it was a very new time. The idea of celebrity was very new. I mean, you had theater actors who were sort of celebrities, and you had boxers, but it wasn't quite the same as this mass entertainment thing that happened. And Cobb, you know, you got to give him credit for kind of cutting his own path to the forest and kind of inventing the idea of celebrity, inventing himself. I mean, here's a guy who came to the major leagues in 1905, in August of 1905, 2.5 weeks after his mother accidentally shot and killed his father. We're still not 100% sure about that, but she was arrested, tried for first degree manslaughter and acquitted, but that took, you know, several months for all that to unfold. And while that's happening, he's coming up to the major leagues, arrives in Detroit. It's his first time he's ever seen a major league game. He sat on the bench. He didn't play that first game, but he played the next day. And he finished out the season, didn't have a great rest of the season, only batted .240. But the next season he came back, and he started to become the Ty Cobb that we know.
The all-time hit leader.
Right, he still is. Well, not the hit leader, but the batting average.
Batting average.
366 or 367. There's still people still debate with one or the other. And so he created that celebrity, that superstar. He was the first superstar thing going on. And that's actually led to a problem for him because the other players left him alone in 1905 when he came up and was kind of lousy. But as soon as he showed up and was good, they started to haze him mercilessly. So he had his mother and the mother and father thing going on, and he was getting hazed. And the next year he had a nervous breakdown in 1906 and was missing for 44 days. But it's funny, to your point about those, who's telling the story, the sports writers, He's the hottest rookie in baseball. He has what was then called a nervous breakdown. He drops out, disappears. Sports writers say virtually nothing about his disappearance of the because it was a shameful thing in those days to have a nervous breakdown, and that was the protocol, that you didn't say anything about it. He just went away. You know, people had relatives who went away for these kind of mental and emotional problems, and when he came back 44 days later, no one mentioned, hey, he's back. You know, no one said that either. So the press was figuring out how to cover baseball. Right. There were a lot of newspapers in those days. It was covered very thoroughly on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, the teams paid for the players, for the press to travel on away games.
So it was all positive press. You weren't getting the sort of stuff now. You weren't necessarily having these big thought pieces about, sort of, you know, athletes of our time. It was mostly box scores and things like that.
Yeah, the sports writers liked a good drama when it couldn't be avoided, when it was out on the field. You know, players, part of the rowdiness we talk about was players often fought with each other or with teammates, with opposition, with umpires. I mean, physical fights, they punch out umpires and they get suspended like a day and a half or something. You know, it was a crazy time. And so that's who was covering this new thing of sports writers was new, but mass media, everyone knew who Cobb was in the whole country. Mm-hmm. He was the biggest draw in baseball. He was once got an award here in Chicago for being the most popular out-of-town player. So the idea that he was a demon and that he was hated everywhere he went, people loved to boo him because he was so effective against their team. But they turned out in huge numbers to see him because he was the most exciting
player. Let's move ahead. Let's talk about Al Stumps, because I think that he's the I mean, and your research is the guy who the story might sort of have started with, or at least sort of, you know, helped move it forward.
Right. Al Stump was a hack sports writer that Cobb encountered in the late 50s. He's long since retired now, Cobb, and in fact, he's dying and when this happens in like 1959 or 1960. He wants to write a book to set the record straight, Cobb does, about his career and how he wasn't a dirty player, because those charges still dogged him from the people who didn't know better. But it was all about spiking. It wasn't about racism or misogyny or anything like that. And so he writes his book with Stump. It was one of those as told to sports biographies. Stump tries to keep it, not show him the manuscript. When Cobb finally sees it, he flips out because it's full of inaccuracies and just fantasy that Stump has made. Not anti-Cobb at that point, just things that didn't happen that Stump found it easier to just make up at the typewriter. Cobb tries to get the book stopped, but he's dying at the time, so he dies before he can get the publication stopped. The book comes out. It doesn't do very well. Because one reason, it's full of errors. And a couple months later, Stump writes an article in True Magazine, ironically it was called, depicting Cobb as a drunk, pill-popping, as you say, like a crazy old man, waving a gun around, scaring all the female members of his family, just a horrible human being. No racism yet in the story. But and people are fascinated by this. They're riveted by it. You got to put yourself back in the time. It's 9 years before Jim Boughton's book, Ball Four, which exposed baseball players as, you know, vulgar, hard-drinking, you know, womanizing.
So this was sort of a really well-known celebrity.
Right, 1961. Right. And so people were saying, oh, my God, this is amazing. And, you know, to a degree, it made sense because it fit with the fierce Cobb on the base paths, that Cobb, that image. And it was a very titillating story. So people loved that story, and they repeated it and told it, embroidered upon it like a game of telephone. And the myth grew and grew. I like to say that a snowball turned into an avalanche of lies, you know. Mm-hmm. One thing that happened in the 80s, another author came along and I think honestly made a mistake with a couple of people and misidentified as black several white guys that Cobb famously fought with, had fist fights with. And so the myth of racism then started to get folded in. People also assume Cobb was born in 1886 in Georgia. He must be a racist. You know, how could he not be a racist? But I went back and I found an answer to that, oddly enough, although I wasn't expecting to find it. I found out that Cobb descended on his father's side from a long line of abolitionists, that his great-grandfather had been a preacher who preached against slavery and got run out of town for his troubles. His grandfather refused to fight in the Civil War because of the slavery issue. And his father was a state senator who stood up for his black constituents and who once broke up a lynch mob in town. And Cobb himself said nothing about race on the record until 1952, when the Sporting News asked him about the integration of the Texas League. And he said, the Negro should be accepted wholeheartedly and not grudgingly. The Negro has the right to play professional baseball, and who's to say he has not?
Well, yeah, that doesn't sound like what we...
There's Ty
Cobb. So, and then, the, you know, in I guess modern times, and then I guess with the 90s, the Tommy Lee Jones movie comes mm-hmm. out that says, you know, which was a flop. But the idea, that was based on Al Stump
right.
and some of the work that he had done. Like, it was an adapted screenplay, right?
Right. Ron Shelton, the director and the screenwriter, bought the screen rights to that True Magazine article and then suggested that Stump write another book. And Stump sat down without doing any more research and just off the top of his head banged out another book of lies about Cobb. The thing we should know about, we should emphasize about Stump, he wasn't just a hack writer who made mistakes. He forged Ty Cobb's autograph and sold it. He created a fraudulent counterfeit, I should say, Ty Cobb memorabilia, which he sold for thousands of dollars to collectors. He was a bad guy, and he ruined Ty Cobb's reputation. But he created a myth that is... resonated with people, and people love this myth of the monster, the baseball playing monster.
As we wrap up, why do you think they love it?
Well, I think there's three reasons. I think it's titillating, you know, and so it, they love it for that reason. I think it fit well with, I say, the fierce Cobb, so that made sense to them, and they said, aha, now I know the whole story. But the most powerful reason, I think, is because it gave them something to feel superior to. They could denounce this man as a racist, misogynist, but I'm not like him. You know, oh, look at this poor guy caught up in his own hatred, choking on his own hatred. I'm not like that. So that's what I think. Mm. But in any case, it's a singular American story.
You know? It's fascinating. Charles Learson, former executive editor at Sports Illustrated, written a new biography on Ty Cobb, sort of taking on the myth. Ty Cobb, a terrible beauty. Charles, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us about the book, about the story, and trying to set the record straight on Ty Cobb.
My pleasure, Justin.